Hello, and welcome to the Mystagogy podcast, offered as part of the adult faith programs at St. Stephen Martyr Church in Chesapeake, Virginia. In a tradition dating back to the earliest centuries of Christianity, newly initiated believers were prepared for ongoing lives of faith through mystagogy, a period of formation designed to deepen their spiritual, liturgical, and community life. Mystagogy is a Greek word which means leading through the mysteries. This program is being developed and taught by Barbara Nicolosi Harrington, a university professor of screenwriting, cinema, great books, and theology. Today's episode is the first of two presentations on Brideshead Revisited by Evelyn Waugh.
Hello, and welcome to a kind of special session here of the St. Stephen's Mystagogy program. We accidentally lost the recording of the session that we did on Brideshead Revisited Part 1 in front of the whole group of 40 people. So I am going to do a recap of it here, so that we keep our continuum of all of the texts we read this fall and not deprive you of this great session here on this book, the introduction to it. So it's a little flatter because I don't have an audience that I'm talking to, but here it goes. I'm going to jump in with the content. This is a great work, Brideshead Revisited. If you haven't read it, as a Catholic, a modern postmodern Catholic, really should. It has the ability in it to place just about every kind of Catholic that you're going to meet in your life, including yourself, through the different characters, and also non-Catholics, the way they encounter us, the way they think of us, the way they think of themselves in life. That this book situates Catholicism in the postmodern world, the dawn of the postmodern world, and all of the quiet doubts and questions that we carry in us because we're swimming in these modern / postmodern waters are brought to the fore in Brideshead Revisited. So it's absolutely worth reading and brooding over and saying, which character really speaks to me? Which one do I understand the best? And then which ones don't I understand? And it'll be interesting for you to figure out if the ones you are more like the ones you understand or the more like the ones you don't. I know for me, that's been the case. So yeah, we've just hit recently the 75th anniversary of this work, and it is still going strong based not only on the text itself, but particularly the series that was done in the 80s, like 12 parts or something, but very worth watching. One of the best adaptations of a text ever done. And certainly there have been two other film versions of this, and they're horrible because you cannot do what Evelyn Waugh is doing in a 2-hour movie. Now, my take on Brideshead is represented here in the title, that Catholic thing. And I'm going to say that it's what the sacraments do to us, how they ruin us for the modernism and postmodernism and living in the secular society, that there's something about the ongoing life of the sacraments, especially, that make us ill-suited to the temporal sphere in the sense of its just focused on the here and now and the moment and without any meaning, that the sacraments give us an inner sight. They are visible signs of invisible realities. And the more you enter into them, the more those invisible realities become present to you and in many ways reveal the meaning of the visible realities. If you're conscious of that, great. But if you're not, and if you find yourself like Julia and Sebastian in this book, they're just kind of going through the motions in some ways, but just the practice of the faith gets in them. It gets in them, messes them up for worldliness. So that's my thesis of what Anthony, the devil character in the book, means by that Catholic thing, right? That he says in a kind of in a hateful way. What is that Catholic thing? And I think Evelyn Waugh is trying to get at that. He's talking in a, he's writing in a Protestant context, looking at the world in the middle of World War II, which is in arguably the most Christian country in Europe. Germany has become this demonic stronghold. And Evelyn Waugh is wondering, what happened to their Christianity? And I think the answer is the lack of sacraments. That's what I think. Anyway, let's jump in here. And just by way of a little bit more intro to the book, you should know that if you Google the 100 greatest Catholic novels, and there's 50 different lists where all these great people, scholars, have put their lists up, Bride's Head is on everybody's list of the greatest Catholic novel ever written. It is. And honestly, I would judge any list of Catholic novels that didn't have it as being not worth your time. Huh? But beyond even just that, it's one of those books that appears on secular lists as well. Not just the Catholics, but the Modern Library Association says that it's one of the 100 greatest novels of the 20th century. Think of all the novels that have been written in the 20th century. For this profoundly Catholic book to make the cut says something about the quality of the writing. New York Times writes that of Evelyn Waugh's whole oeuvre, and he has many books, this one is his finest achievement. And it's arguably his most, and I think Helena, the book he wrote, Helena, probably a little more overt, but Bride's Head is definitely in his top three or four most Catholic works. And the New York Times says it's his finest achievement. Worth your time, just as a piece of literature, or indeed as a piece of Catholic literature. And then here's the miniseries I mentioned, which many people think is the greatest TV miniseries ever done. Is certainly one of the best adaptations ever achieved. Just had its 30th anniversary, but American Conservative says Bride's Head still stands as the sine qua non of miniseries, which is a relic from the Shogun era before the universality of remote control sapped the audience's patience. What are they saying there? They're saying that there is a lot of the pacing of the piece is more reflective. There's a lot of, it's driven by conversations. There's not a lot of visual action going on. Having said that, it's a masterpiece for actors. And you have some great ones here, Laurence Olivier and Jeremy Irons, to name a couple. But the way they do the book, they really are faithful to the book, which is so rare in adaptations. But this one, they really hewed very close to the book. So if you have trouble reading, which as many people do, we're losing the ability to read thoughtfully and today, then the miniseries does stand as a great way to get at the book, okay? So Evelyn Waugh, just a little bit about him before we get into the book. So he says this, I was 16 years old when I realized that Catholicism was Christianity, that all other forms of Christianity were only good insofar as they had chipped little bits off the main block. Huh? This is a great insight that when it hits you, you say, oh, the Catholic Church is keeping all of the Jesus stuff together, that Jesus left us all this stuff that makes us holy, that has the power of sanctifying us and saving us. And it's things, it's the Eucharist, it's the church, the community of the church, it's the magisterial teaching of the church. It's the scriptures, right? The Catholic Church has kept the scriptures and preserved them since the beginning. But the traditions, the things like the sort of the sacraments are rooted in tradition, but the traditions of the church in terms of the way we pray. You look at the Desert Fathers' spirituality, which forms the essential tradition of Christian spirituality applied. And you just keep going of all of the stuff that Jesus set up and left us the seeds, and then we've been growing them. This is all in the, when we say the Catholic Church is the fullness of truth, that she retains the full deposit of faith, that's the bank. She's the bank. And what you have is different denominations of Christianity who have made withdrawals on that bank, and they've taken a little bit of it and gone and set up their own storefront, whether it's Martin Luther or Henry VIII or any of the 6,000 people who followed in their stead to set up their own storefront based on a withdrawal from the main account. So this is a huge insight that Evelyn Waugh figures out, that the Catholic Church is the fullness of truth, but that there is saving grace throughout Christendom. It's all saving, and that by God's special grace, people can make it basically just eating the crackers. If you picture the whole deposit of faith as this amazing banquet of saving food, there are people who can be saved just by nibbling on the dry crackers because God's grace is that strong and powerful. So this is something that comes to him. And so I think that this is the heart of the book, is this question of what does the whole thing played out look like in human life today? When you're not just doing parts of it, but that you've absorbed all of it, what does it look like? Having said this, Evelyn Waugh believed his greatest book, as he says here, by far the best book I have ever written or will ever write, is his autobiography, or excuse me, his biography of St. Helena, the one who finds the true cross, according to tradition, and that he loved this book and he thought it was the most profound thing he wrote, and from a Catholic standpoint, the best. So do check that book out. I haven't read it for years. I read it years and years ago in high school, so I'd like to look at it again. But check it out, because if he's to be trusted, there's a lot of treasures there. Okay, so let me just quickly say a little bit about the story of Bride's Head. Bride's Head Revisited is basically set during World War II. It's actually bookended by World War II, and then we go back into the past. We go back into the 20s. But it's 1943, and this man, Charles Ryder, who's an officer, and his battalion has been sent to ready an army camp on an old estate. And when morning dawns and he looks, he realizes he has been to this estate before. And when we first meet him, he's very low-key. It's like a man who's a little bit dead. He has lost his outrage. He's just dragging around with the army in this war, kind of bored and just showing up barely. But as a human person, he feels like there's something dead in him. And then he wakes up and he sees, oh, I've been here before. And that leads us into the story of the bride when he first went. That idea of, okay, so what happens in the past? He is at Oxford and he meets a Lord Sebastian Flight, this dandy. Lord Sebastian is a dandy. He's handsome and charming and beautifully attired. He's the second son of a ridiculously wealthy aristocratic Catholic family. And Sebastian and Charles bond pretty fast, and he brings Charles into his family circle, which is, he has two sisters, Julia, the older one, and Cordelia is the youngest in the family. He has an older brother who's called Bridey. And then we meet Lady Marchmain, who is distinguished by being a devout Catholic. Sebastian is rebelling against his mother, and he becomes, over the course of the book, basically a dissolute alcoholic. And from Charles' standpoint, it's all his mother's fault because she's been pressing him to be this Catholic, and Catholicism is ridiculous, according to Charles. And he doesn't understand what's the big deal at all. And he thinks Sebastian should just laugh it off. But for some reason, Sebastian can't laugh it off. But while they're hanging out together, Charles starts to paint, and his love for Sebastian and the love bleeds over into the love of the beautiful. And so he begins painting, and he starts painting in one of the parlor rooms at Bride's Head. And then they go off to Venice at a certain point together and meet up with Sebastian's long lost father, who Lord Flight, who has been hiding in Italy, in Venice. He has a mistress there, and basically he has fled the mother too, and has, we find, just living there full of anger and hatred towards her, and that he and Sebastian connect in their hatred, their mutual hatred for this woman, Lady Marchmain. Julia, in her desire to flee this Catholic thing, marries this capitalist named Rex and finds out that he's already been married. And so she ends up having to marry him outside the faith, which causes her mother a broken heart. And then the marriage, she has a miscarriage at a certain point. Rex cheats on her. She has no morality at all. And then it ends in divorce. Cordelia tries to be a nun, but they end up telling her she doesn't have a vocation. Which to Charles, this is like so mysterious. What do you mean you don't have a vocation? They sent you home. And she's like, yeah, I just couldn't fake it. I didn't have it. And so she becomes a nurse and ends up like think about the secular nuns of today. They wear sensible shoes and polyester clothing and they do their duty. That's how you imagine Cordelia. Although I always think she's one of the most charming characters in the story because of her honesty. Eventually, Lady Marchmain just dies of what seems to be a broken heart, that her children, Sebastian has become an alcoholic, Julia is outside the faith. It has no grounding. Cordelia is just wandering around looking for something to do. And the oldest bridey, too, is unmarried and just doesn't seem to have any particular ambition. So the question is, did she fail them that all of her children are floundering? We see Sebastian finally ends up in North Africa, where he's taking care of a wretched semi-barbarian guy with a rotting foot. And Charles finds him there and is horrified that Sebastian, who loved beauty and elegance, is now cleaning the putrid pus out of this man's foot every day, who is very barbaric. He's an uncivilized brute who ends up with the Nazis and then gets killed for whatever. But Sebastian is caring for him, and Charles doesn't get that. Charles gets married, trying to find some kind of permanence, some kind of family, which he's always longed for. And his wife cheats on him, and so he takes off to go paint. On the way back from painting in the Americas, he meets Julia on the ship, and they begin an affair, and he realizes that Sebastian was just the precursor, that his real love is Julia, but that Sebastian was the one who taught him how to love. So in the end, all of a sudden, Lord Marchmain announced that he's coming back to Bride's Head to die. His wife is dead now, so that makes it safe for him. And he comes home, and then there's this massive fight between Charles and the family of whether they should bring a priest in at the end. And Charles is desperate that they not, because he senses that he's going to lose Julia if she returns to her faith. And sure enough, the father has a kind of interesting deathbed sign of accepting God, which is elicited by a prayer from Charles that he's made quietly. And then Julia says, we're done now, when Lord Marchbane dies. So then we flip back to the future, and Charles finds himself in the chapel that they have just re-put into service, that it had been for 15 years, whatever, it had been snuffed out because their family was gone. But now the army is pushing it back into service, and he's watching as they light the sanctuary light and put Jesus in the tabernacle, and he finds himself kneeling there and all of a sudden understanding the comfort and consolation of the Eucharist and that presence of God in the heart of the home, that it, what it's going to mean for the soldiers. So you get the sense that at the very end, Charles is like, by going back over the whole experience, he's put it together. He doesn't understand it necessarily, but he accepts it. And so at the end, he has a dawning faith. Okay. So let's start analyzing this book by talking about Charles, because he is our way into the family. He's our way into the story. I would say Charles is that person you meet, if you're Catholic, who is the attracted agnostic, right? Somebody who comes alongside of you and is intrigued by your faith while still thinking it's not relevant to him, but that there is a kind of weird fascination. And the fascination might be for you as the Catholic, but the person, the Charles writer, thinks it's just because of your personality and doesn't realize that what he's really attracted to is the aroma of grace and faith that is around you. You might not even be aware of it, right? But that you are exuding the residual effects of the sacraments and of the scriptures, of being in the community of the church, of going through things like Marian feast days and saying rosaries at funerals and trotting through cemeteries on November 2nd to get a plenary indulgence for the people that you've lost, for saying novenas and wearing scapulars and dipping your hands in holy water and like all of these things that you do have given you the aroma of the church, the aroma of God, and you don't even know it. But Charles, who doesn't have any other belief system, is looking for love. And in fact, you have this beautiful quote, huh? I was in search of love in those days when he was young. He's written this when he's thinking back, huh? And being in college. He said, and I went to Bride's Head the first time, full of curiosity and the faint, unrecognized apprehension that here at last I should find that low door in the wall, which others I knew had found before me, which opened on an enclosed and enchanted garden. So I love that he's drawn to be around these people, the flights, but he's also afraid that he might catch their disease and then have to go into an enclosed garden that it might cut him off from who he is, from the world he knows, etc. So the other thing to know about Charles is that he, as the window to the flights, and especially Lady Marchbane, he's an unreliable narrator, that Charles's biases make him someone who we can't really trust to tell us who these people are. Because first of all, he has a kind of romantic attraction to Sebastian. I would say romantic and not sexual. And I think that Evelyn Waugh goes out of his way to make that point over and over. First of all, he introduces the homosexual characters very clearly and speaks, really sets them apart. And there's one scene where Charles goes into a gay bar in the book with Antony, and all of the gay guys are there, and Charles is like, whoa, this is not my world. And Evelyn Waugh makes it very clear. Having said that, it's undeniable that he loves Sebastian and that they're, quote, in love in that way that the mistress of Lord Marchmain calls that romantic friendships that the English young men have that they get because of going to the whole education system was same sex in England for the most part. And so you would go to places like Eton and then Oxford and Cambridge, and they would be all male worlds. And so young people tend to fall in love with whoever is standing around. And this habit of your first love being someone of the same sex that you met in school, Evelyn Waugh sees as just being part of the British thing. But he doesn't see it as being sexual. And in fact, makes the distinction that when Charles falls in love with Juliet, it's a whole other thing than the way he felt for Sebastian. Okay, but having said that, Charles is unreliable. We can't trust his assessment because he, and especially as the story goes on in the beginning, as he gets angrier and angrier at Lady Marchmain and the Catholic Church for what he sees, what he thinks is ruining Sebastian, then his bias about Catholicism, at Christianity, and the life that they're living as Catholics makes him skewed in how he sees it. Also, he's unreliable because he hasn't, in the beginning of the story, he has no interest in really finding out why. The whys of Catholicism. He's utterly uninterested. And because he doesn't get the whys, he rejects the hows consistently. Oh, this is ridiculous, you people. Why do you have to bring up God all the time? And then you have, I think it was Cordelia saying to him, because he's there, isn't he? And Charles is like, no, he's never been there for me, but for you people, you're obsessed. He doesn't really have the depth of interest to, if he really loved Sebastian, then when Sebastian tells him, I actually really believe this stuff, because Charles is like, it's all rubbish, isn't it? And Sebastian's like, I wish it was rubbish, but I don't think it's rubbish. And Charles, if he really loved him, would say, wow, I want to find out too. What is it? You're my friend. I want to know, but he doesn't. Huh? So as Charles becomes more alienated from the Catholic Church as the root of all what he considers Sebastian's problems, and then Julia's, his view of these things that he's describing in the book is skewed. And he actually gives a hearing to Antony, who I believe the voice of hell in the movie. I think the Evelyn Waugh sets him up as the devil in the story. And Charles having dinners and lunches and drinks with Antony periodically, letting that voice into his head in a way that he doesn't really with Lady Marchmain. He goes on a couple of her little talks, but it's not any kind of friendly thing. Although he does come to see that Antony scares him off, I think, at a certain point. Okay, so interesting technique, the unreliable narrator. It leaves the reader with the problem of who do I trust here? When you realize finally that the narrator's unreliable, then you're like, who do I trust in the story to tell me what's really true? And that's one of the questions of the book. So another thing about Charles is that we meet his father several scenes, and his father is a cold, distant, and selfish man. He is a man going through the motions of life with no purpose or passion. And you have Charles saying this finally, to know and love one other human being is the root of all wisdom. He comes to this because of his love for Sebastian and then Julia. And he is particularly sensitive to this because his father has given him no love at all. When Julia says to Charles, you're looking for love. Charles says, no, I'm not. And she's like, yeah, you are. And it's because he's a little boy whose father has been AWOL and has been cruel and left him without love. I think that Yves Lenoir thinks this is predicable of a lot of people in the modern / postmodern era. But people are being told that they need to go out and fulfill themselves. They need to have put number one first. Don't let your family or your friends or whatever get in the way of you pursuing your own actualization. And that this results in a lot of children being lost, not being given the attention and love that they deserve. That their parents are too interested in their own creature comforts or their own trying to find their own star. And so I think that's why Charles is given as our way into the story. He's one of the walking wounded in the modern world that's going to encounter the Catholic Church. So one of the things the book presents is that in a world where you don't have family, because you've been dropped on your head, that friendship can become a place to belong. So you have this beautiful line. He says, that summer term with Sebastian, I was being given a happy childhood. Even though they're both in college, like they're, it's 15 years too late. Having said that, it's something he's never experienced. A happy childhood. People who delight in him. This is, his family should have done this. Huh? But didn't. But that is, there is hope there then in friendship. And I think that when you look at it from the Catholic standpoint, Yves Lenoir is saying that the way into Catholicism for many people, especially walking wounded modern people, is going to be friendship. That if we just love them in the way that Jesus called us friends, that will get them over the dogma hump, maybe, on our own limits as people explaining theology. It's like, but just love them and be open to them and give them a welcome and give them kindness and let them work out the rest. Another lovely line of Yves Lenoir is, he says, we cherish our friends not for their ability to amuse us, but for ours to amuse them. That in the end, that's what belonging is. I've found the people who delight in me. And so the flights do delight in Charles. They open their lives to him and they love him. They think he's charming and interesting. And so there he is. And it's interesting because we're not quite sure what the attraction is on their part for him. We're very clear what the attraction for him is of them because he describes them all with such detail. And they are a fascinating group of people. And we're like, why are they interested in Charles? And we don't know because Charles doesn't have that ability to look at himself, very unreflective of his own state. Having said that, it's clear that he's found people who like him and who embrace him into their world. And that's ultimately the gift of friendship. Okay, so this is that description of the romantic friendships of the English and the Germans, according to the mistress character. Huh? She says, they're very good if they don't go too long. It's a kind of love that comes to children before they know its meaning, right? That's what she's saying of these the friendships that tend to be infatuation, same-sex friendships that go into infatuation. Okay, so that's Charles. Now, we got to look at Lady Marchmain as the kind of essential main character of the story. And I think she is the church. My contention is that Our Lady Marchmain is the church. Now, a lot of people don't like it when I say this because they're like, she's awful. She's cold or she's unfeeling and she puts pressure on Sebastian and she's manipulative and tries to get Charles on her side and all this stuff. And I'm like, yes, but that is the perspective of two people, really. Sebastian, who's running from the church, and Charles, his best friend, who just wants Sebastian to be happy. It's also, by the way, the view of the most insidious character. The one who hates her the most, arguably, in the book is Antony. also her husband, right? Who's also just a grown-up Sebastian running away. But Antony just can barely speak of her without spitting. And she has my contention is she absolutely represents the church, Holy Mother Church. Huh? And she says this about her children. All I ever wanted was to see them safe. And all they do is hate me. Can't you see that language on the lips of Holy Mother Church? Huh? That Mother Church says to us, no, you can't live with your boyfriend out of wedlock. No, you can't get your tubes tied because you don't want any more babies. No, you can't use birth control. No, you can't. No, you can't sleep in on Sunday morning. You have to get up and go to Mass. No, you can't eat meat on Fridays of Lent, etc. That Holy Mother Church keeps telling us things for our good that we don't want to hear. And so it can cause us to resent the church and cause many people to walk away. I've met many of these people in my life who speak about the Catholic Church. Oh, the church with all her rules, huh? Actually, there's only 5 precepts of the church, right? 4, if you want to put the marriage ones in their own category. But so there are 4 rules about being Catholic, but there's a whole bunch of things that the Catholic Church will say to you. This will hurt you. This will be harmful, very much the way a mother would. And so this question of why do people hate the church? Some people are going to say because a priest was mean to me or a nun was mean to me. But I think there's a whole bunch more who hate the church because the church dares to tell them they cannot do what they want. When I was working in Hollywood, I met a lot of this kind of person. It's like, how can you let, you know, some old priest in a dress tell you what you can do or not? That perception of the church bridling license, the license of people, is why some people hate her. And I think that's Lady Marchmain in the book, right? She's trying to bridle Sebastian for his own good. And she doesn't know what to do really besides just keep telling him and keep saying after him, nagging him. And I think that's, church nags us a bit. St. Justin Martyr has this beautiful thought that the world suffers nothing from Christians, but hates them because they reject its pleasures, right? Christians say to the world, this thing you're doing, getting drunk and being wasted. And so in that Sebastian's particular vice, right? The church says, that's bad, Sebastian. You're ruining your life. You're not meant to spend your life intoxicated. You're meant to be thoughtful. And this makes Sebastian hate the church because the church is saying this thing that he likes to do is actually not good for him. And so Justin Martyr, way back, and we're talking, I think Justin Martyr's like early second century. Huh? He's saying that already the Christians are hated because they say to the Greco-Roman world, no, the things you do are not good. Your theaters, your centers of prostitution, your gymnasiums, your what do you call it? The gladiator games. These are not good things for people. And so the Greco-Roman era hates Christians. We saw this. I found this on Google, where there's a group of people. We accuse the Roman Catholic Church of perpetuating worldwide hatred by promoting homophobia, sexism, racism, and the AIDS pandemic, right? So instead of being a Catholic, you know, practice love and compassion towards all people. Tell them whatever their sexual orientation is or whatever they want to do, they're okay. And promote safe sex worldwide. Everybody should have as much sex as they want with anybody all the time. Don't listen to the church. And yes, there's a way to stop AIDS, and it has to do with safe sex, and don't listen to the church. Right? This perception of the church as perpetuating homophobia, and AIDS and disease and everything like that, because it doesn't play the world's games, right? Still with us today. Here's just a picture I found on Google, right? And there's a lot. We need to get off the God standard. And the Catholic Church has put the voice of the God standard in the world. Right? Is the Catholic Church a homophobic institution that promotes hate and fear? Antony thinks so in Brideshead Revisited. So we're seeing right now the church being excoriated and desecrated, her churches, our churches, for saying to the world, no, you don't get to kill people. You don't get to kill your elderly, yourself, or your children. And this is causing rage. And it always has. Resentment is nasty. What makes it so ugly is that it has a tendency to turn you, an otherwise kind and reasonable person, into someone who is so angry at their own life situation that it is nearly impossible to recover. Bitterness and resentment make it hard, even for the people who love you around, to be around you. I think that we're seeing an entire culture of cultivated resentment, and a huge amount of it is turned towards Christianity. You people are making us unhappy. You're ruining our lives by your refusal to sign off on the spirit of the age. And so the resentment, the bitterness is making us nice people. It's making people angry and touchy and like walking on eggshells around each other and very much looking for a fight, spoiling for a fight. This is all what is happening in our culture. Okay, Lord Marchmain is the husband of Lady Marchmain, and he is a perpetual petulant who has been living in resentment. His mistress, Kara, says this, why does he stay with me? Because I protect him from her, from Lady Marchmain. He hates her. My friend, he is a volcano of hate. But Sebastian hates her too. So father and son have this hatred for Lady Marchmain in the book. And you say, why? Lady Marchmain is always speaking about her brothers, who were these models of discipleship, mainly, right? But citizenship and heroism. They both died in World War I. And they were good, and it seems like almost holy men. So Kara says, how has she deserved all this hate? She's done nothing except be loved by someone who is not a grown-up. When people hate with all that energy, it is something in themselves they are hating. Alex is hating all the illusions of boyhood, innocence, God, and hope, right? So the idea here is that Lady Marchmain is just living consciously with her husband and her son, Sebastian, and asking them to be authentic disciples and grown-up men. Be a grown-up. Be self-sacrificing. Be serious and thoughtful. Deny yourself your creature comforts. Be a man of service to the world and to others. Be a person of prayer and discipline. That's all she's asking, but she's asking it of her husband, who isn't a grown-up, and that makes him petulant and angry. And it's like, wow, as a boy, he thought he could be her hero. As a young man, he thought he could be her hero. But as he grew, he realized it's just too hard. So now he has to hate her. And the same thing with Sebastian. Sebastian, grown up in the shadow of his uncle's and his mother's expectation that he be a man. And he doesn't want to be. He wants to play with his teddy bear. He wants to get drunk, and he wants to have no responsibilities, and he wants to hang out with silly people. And his mother is calling him to more, and so he hates her. It's a real interesting dynamic present here that we could think about, huh? And say, who in my life is calling me to be a grown-up? And maybe they're not doing it in the best way. Maybe they're doing it in a way that's awkward or they have their own agenda. Their motives aren't completely pure, but they are basically saying, hey, what's your problem? Grow up. Take responsibility. Stop blaming. Get yourself out of bed. Make something of yourself. Stick, follow through with your commitments, whatever. That voice in our life. And you say, the world today will probably tell you that they're toxic. That's a toxic voice. If it makes you feel bad about yourself, then you have to get rid of it. Right? Because you shouldn't feel bad. That's the worst thing. That's what the world is going to say to you. But think about that. Are there people in your life who hold you accountable for whatever reason? And how do you think of them? Are you grateful or do you resent them? Have you ruled them to be toxic? When talking about Lady Marchmain, if you said, how would the devil talk about the church? And here's a line of Antony about Lady Marchmain. This is Antony in the movie. He says, she has a horde of loyal followers, however. She's a bloodsucker and leaves these stragglers with no life in them at all. Can't you just see the devil saying that the church sucks our blood out of us, sucks our passion, sucks out the ubermensch of Nietzsche, makes us humble and self-sacrificing and cowering little carpets that clean up. Look at Mother Teresa. Oh, disgusting. Taking maggot-ridden dead people and comforting them on their way out and all their smells. And instead of being a woman with her own dignity, this woman hasn't had any fun in her whole life. You can imagine that would be what the devil would say about her. And this is what Antony says about Lady Marchmain, that ultimately she has the effect of being a bloodsucker on people, and that people come away, that her followers, with no life in them. I would say no spirit in the Greek sense, where spiritedness was self-will. That the followers of the church appropriate Christ's will, God's will, and over their own. Antony, who is he? These are just some of the ways the book, this is my theory that Antony is the devil, the voice of the devil in the book. He's described as being ageless as a lizard, like the devil is ageless, and a lizard. We know the devil is a snake, so it's close. He's foreign as a Martian. He's not one of us. Antony represents someone who comes into the world from another place. He has a nomad of no nationality. That's how Antony is. He isn't the devil that way. He doesn't belong to any country. We find out that Antony had practiced the black arts, the occult. And Charles says, sometimes we all seemed children beside him. Yeah, innocent. Whereas Antony has no innocence. His vices flourished less in the pursuit of pleasure and more in the desire to shock. He has moved on from being just about creature comforts into this evil pleasure of harming people, of hurting them, of twisting them. The savage we had tamed was still rampant in him. Interesting that Antony has a thin veneer covering, which is a volcano of rage and hate. He was cruel, too, in the wanton, insect-maiming manner of the young and fearless. So that Antony, for all of his pretensions to being a dandy and a man of art and beauty, is actually cruel. And in fact, he says to Sebastian, my dear, I'd like to stick you full of arrows like a pincushion. This harkens back to the death of Saint Sebastian. Saint Sebastian was martyred by being shot through with many arrows. And you get the sense of the devil remembering that with delight and looking at Sebastian in the current age and saying, I'd like to treat you the way I treated the other Sebastian. So I really think that if you look at the book and you read what Antony has to say, talk about an unreliable narrator, he pushes it into the stratosphere. But he's such a cleverly drawn character that you get seduced by him, and Charles almost does. But then at a certain point, Charles gets scared off by him and says, no, And that, I think, is the beginning of the movement of grace in Charles. He has to reject Satan and all his evil works. Now, this is an interesting line, too, about Lady Marchmain and what she does. She has Mr. Samgraff editing a curiously homogeneous little body of writing, poetry, letters, scraps of a journal, an unpublished essay or two. Isn't that kind of like the Bible? The Bible is a library of all different kinds of writing. And what is she saving? Stories of the same high-spirited, serious, chivalrous, otherworldly air, and letters from their contemporaries. Isn't that the Bible, huh? Written after their deaths in varying degrees of articulateness, tells the same tale of men who were in the promise of great rewards ahead, seen somehow as set apart from their fellows, garlanded victims devoted to the sacrifice. I think this is language that absolutely could describe the Bible. And in the book, it's what Lady Marchmain is having this man, Mr. Samgraff, compile, basically stories of her brothers. But I think, again, Evelyn Waugh is wink-winking. He's saying this is her scriptures, just like the church has scriptures. She says this very clearly at one point. Happiness in this life is irrelevant. That I think the church says this to us. That we're meant for happiness in eternity, for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, thousands and thousands. And all we have to do is get through 60 or 70 here, or 10 or 20, whatever we're allotted, and choose. We have this little test where we can see the good, the true, and the beautiful, and either long for it forever or turn away from it. But in that journey of encountering the good, the true, and the beautiful, and then either cleaving to it or rejecting it, whether we're having a good time or not is irrelevant. In fact, we might need to not have a good time to make us more attuned to the good, the true, and the beautiful. This is something the church says to us as mother. St. Thomas Aquinas, perfect happiness is the true, supreme, subjective end of man and is therefore open to all, but not attainable in this life. So basically, Lady Marchmain is just articulating the constant teaching of the church when she says this. Happiness in this life is irrelevant. Yeah, that's 13th century compilation of Aquinas. Some of you will recall the Baltimore Catechism. The Baltimore Catechism was very clear. Why did God make us? God made me to know him, to love him, and to serve him in this world, and to be happy with him forever in heaven. And heaven is our destiny. Here's one last kind of neat parallel between Lady Marchmain, as she's portrayed in the book as suffering for her children. The way you think about Our Lady of Sorrows, whose heart was pierced by a sword, we're told by Simeon is prophesies to Mary that this child will cause you to suffer and will pierce your own heart. Huh? And so we have this line in the book where Charles says, Lady Marchmain saw this and added it to her new grief for Sebastian and her old grief for her husband and to the deadly sickness in her body and took all these sorrows with her daily to church. It seemed her heart was transfixed with the swords of her dolors, a living heart to match the plaster and paint. So it's a direct reference to Our Lady of Sorrows. Okay, now the last character I want to look at tonight is Sebastian. Sebastian is our first look at the Flight family. And he is a perpetual adolescent in the same way his father is. But also at the end of the book, a saint. Cordelia says, I really think Sebastian is a saint, even as he's still an alcoholic, but he's doing this selfless act of service, caring for this disgusting character of Kurt. and he's on the side with the, he is haunting this monk's monastery and can't kick his habit of drinking, but longs to be a better man. And yet, when we first meet him, he's got his teddy bear, Aloysius. Aloysius is a saint of youth. And so it's funny that Sebastian has named his teddy bear Aloysius. He says, I have a good mind not to take Aloysius to Venice. I don't want him to meet a lot of horrid Italian bears and pick up bad habits, which is ironic because all Sebastian is one big bad habit. But he speaks about Aloysius, his teddy bear, like it's a real living person, which is fine if you're 5 or 6, but Sebastian is 20. When do you stop? Kara says, Sebastian is in love with his own childhood, and that will make him very unhappy. And this is very ironic. You probably know people like this, right? That they never had the childhood they wanted, or maybe they did, and it was idyllic, and they can't let it go. But that ultimately, you cannot live childhood in adulthood, that it will make you miserable. You have to let it go. And that when we think about the joys and the delights of childhood, they must be accompanied by immaturity, inexperience, naivety. Like those three things are what makes the delights of childhood so pure and enjoyable. But once you grow up and you get nuance and depth, and you see the shadows and the light and the contrasts, now you can never go back to childhood and see things again as black and white and easy and without nuance, right? It is the impulse of childhood to not have any doubt or any nuance. But grown-ups, yeah, we live with the paradox. So Sebastian is presented to us in the same language as St. Augustine. We have very much here mirroring the language of Augustine. When Augustine is caught up in his sex addiction, and he's come to see that he has to get rid of it, that he's not going to become the man he's meant to be as long as he's chained to this. And so he makes this funny prayer, oh God, make me good, free me from this, but not yet. And we hear Sebastian articulate exactly the same thing. Oh God, make me good, but not yet. Again, here is him longing for childhood. If only it could always be like this, always summer, always alone without his mother, the fruit always ripe and my teddy bear in a good temper, everything easy and simple. If only it could be like this always. Grow up, Marine. Man up, Marine. Knock it off. You being an adult is demanding, but it's rewarding. But you have to renounce your childhood. You have to be willing to move into the next stage. And Sebastian is not. No one has ever spiritually matured without applying themselves to spiritual discipline. Right? So at a certain point, you have to decide to grow up as a disciple. Church has moved confirmation away from baptism, I think, kind of really trying to make that point even stronger. We're gonna confirm you at the age of 15 or 16 and say to you, there's the little slap of confirmation, which isn't in the rite anymore. Unfortunately, I loved it. The idea of wake up now, grow up. It's time to assume responsibility for your own life as a disciple. Here are signs of spiritual maturity just for conversation. How do you know you're a grown-up disciple? You're a grown-up Christian. We have Robert E. Lee here saying one kind of thing, huh? Do your duty in all things. You cannot do more, and you should never wish to do less. And I think this is true of spiritual maturity in general. What is my duty? My duty to God, my duty to my own soul, my duty to my neighbor, my duty to my family, my duty to my coworkers, my duty to my friends. That spiritual maturity is doing your duty in all of these areas. So here's some points of signs that you are grown up in the Lord, that you are spiritually mature. And these are the things that both Julia and Sebastian and Lord Marchmain are fleeing, right? A mature person is unshaken by flattery or criticism. Their people's estimation of them is not what they're living for. A mature person can delay gratification. Say, no, I'm not going to do that just because it feels good. I'm not going to have that extra two pieces of pie. I'm not going to say those cruel words of a vengeful spirit just to get back at somebody. I'm not going to whatever. I'm not going to swing back. Huh? I'm going to delay gratification. A spiritually mature person can stay with commitments long-term. Perseverance, that when it stops being novel and interesting, they can keep to their commitments. I'm thinking of my sister taking care of my mother with Alzheimer's, and we're 3 years into it now, and we're way past the novel stage, and cleaning up an adult, a grown-up who is incontinent, who can't use forks and knives anymore, gets food all over, and who is fighting us at all every turn. This is not fun anymore. Not that it ever was, but it's really not fun now. And it's like, okay, so now we have to stay at it. But my sister is very faithful to her duty to mom, and it's very impressive. A mature person has a spirit of humility about them, and humility is truth. Huh? They know who they are. They know who God is. They know they're not God. I love the line of Anne Lamott, what's the difference between God and us? God never thinks he's us. That's very good. A spiritual mature person is not ruled by their emotions. They're not afraid of their emotions, and you don't think your emotions are bad. It's part of, goes along with the physiology that God has given us. Having said that, we understand that our rational factor is the guide of the emotions. And a spiritually mature person doesn't let their feelings run away with them and lead them around by the nose. I had one lady come to me and when I was teaching moral theology at my last parish, and I said, you can't just turn the other blind eye when your adult children bring home their boyfriends and girlfriends and want to spend the night in your house. And this woman came up to me and she said, my son and his girlfriend are living upstairs and it's bothering his father and me very much, but we're afraid if we tell him no, we'll lose our son. And I said, so basically you're afraid. And so you've already lost your son. First of all, if he's doing this thing to you, it shows he has no respect for you or your values. But number two, basically, your reason tells you that his soul matters, his spiritual condition, but you're more afraid of incurring his wrath, having him dump you, leave you lonely, you'll be humiliated and all of that. So therefore, you're going to let those feelings dictate what you do. No. A mature person is able to say thank you and mean it, to really see when other people give them a gift. And to accept help. Oh my gosh. It's one of the biggest things I think people struggle with is the ability to accept help and kindness, especially from your friends, right? When your people who love you say, let me help you here. Let me do something for you. No, I got it. I got it. I'm okay. And so much of that is just pride. And it's like God is sending them to you to be someone to help you get through, to bear your burdens together. That's what we do in the church. We bear each other's burdens. But I don't want to have to admit that I need help. So that's, you're not able to express gratitude because you're not able to accept help. A spiritually mature person is able to ask for forgiveness. I think that one of the real signs of spiritual growth is that the distance between the fall and the asking for forgiveness gets shorter and shorter. when you're immature, you can wait 2 years, 2 weeks, 2 months to say you're sorry. Sometimes some people won't say they're sorry. I have someone in my life right now who's incapable of saying, I'm sorry, just moves on and lets a few weeks go by and then all of a sudden looks and says, oh, hi, how are you doing? And you're just like, so we're never going to actually confront the water under the bridge. We're just going to move on, right? And so just be simple. Don't make people want to throw up when you ask for forgiveness. Oh, I'm scum. I'm terrible. How can you stand me? No. Just say, you know what? I'm like the straw man. My straw fell out again. That's some more of me again. Please forgive me. I got up on the wrong side of the bed and did something stupid. I don't even know why. Please forgive me. That's it, right? But that being able to do that simply and quickly is a sign of growth. Finally, a sign of spiritual maturity is that you not only have a sense of your own rights and your own value and worth, but you're very conscious that other people have it too. So when we say loving others as we love ourselves, that's no small thing, because we are so attuned to our own needs that the era of narcissism, we live in the era of narcissism blessed and validated, right? That it's good to be primarily concerned about your own self-esteem and your own needs as you perceive them. But the truth is, most people have to understand that you cannot satisfy your needs by trampling on other people's needs. And a spiritually mature person recognizes that. So all of these things are what Sebastian and Julia and Lord Marchmain are fleeing. This is what their mother is asking of them. This is what Lady Marchmain is asking. And this is what they do not want. And so they hate her. Having said this, at the end, Sebastian finds someone who's actually worse off than he is. And in the story, it's Kurt. Like, Sebastian needs to discover who he is by an act of love to someone who will take it from him. And Kurt is a narcissistic barbarian with a terrible, disgusting wound. And he needs help. And so Sebastian is able to help him. And in that, Sebastian discovers his identity, Christ-like love, and it saves him. Very interesting. So he can't get over his drinking thing, really, because he doesn't really want to. And he has going to have that flaw forever. Having said that, he can still live the Christ life by looking around him and finding someone who is worse off. Here's the last two characters that I want to mention in the book. They deserve much more treatment than we're going to give them here. But Rex and Celia are two people that are also in the Flights universe who are absolutely godless. They are vacuous ambition. They live the hollow life of living to impress others. They are types of what the postmodern world puts in front of us and says, this is your best life. Julia says, he was something absolutely modern and up to date that only this ghastly age could produce. A tiny bit of a man pretending he was the whole. That there's a whole bunch of people around us in rejecting God, in rejecting the true, the good, and the beautiful, end up replacing it by idolizing other people's impressions of them. And their ambition is to be the top of the heap. There was a book years ago by Trina Paulus called The Caterpillar Pile. Hope for the Flowers, it was called. Hope for the Flowers. And anybody should read it, but it's about caterpillars just trying to climb over each other to get to the top of the pile. And they get to the top of the pile and there's actually nothing there. Just more caterpillars trying to stay on the top of the pile. And this is Rex and Celia. And Rex is honestly one of my favorite characters in the book. He's one of the funniest because Evelyn Waugh really shows him in the absurdity of someone who has no moral center, really, who has no real ability to discern what is true and meaningful and good and has no interest in how ridiculous that gets. So here's the question I'm going to leave you with, and we'll pick this up next week. And that is this expression that Antony uses in several places about the charm of the flights. And Sebastian even mentions this, I'm not going to have you get mixed up with my family. They're so madly charming. And Antony says, "Fight charm, beware the charm of the flights." What is the charm of the flights? What is charm? Charm is a quality that makes us fascinated by someone. Charm is a quality where someone has the ability to captivate us. And I think when you look at the flights, their captivating, fascinating quality is their ability to speak the truth about themselves and the world and shrug and say, yes, well, it's like Sebastian saying, when Charles says, this is all rubbish. And Sebastian's like, oh, I wish it was. You think it is? I suspect it isn't, though. I think it might be true. They're so charming in its honesty that the flights will say things that other people think but never say. The flights will say things that other people will never even think. But that the flights are, in spite of themselves, in spite of even being at war with the church and the church's teaching, they can't help but be conscious of reality. And that makes them charming. Okay, so that's it for today. We will pick this up next time and complete the book. But if I were you, get a copy of Brideshead Revisited and enjoy. It is a great work, and you will thank me. Thank you very much, everybody. Take care.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Mystagogy Podcast. The music for this podcast is provided by George Serra. You can learn more about George and his music via a link in the show notes. Until next time, be well and God bless.